Diabetes affects some 30 million Americans. Another 86 million, that's almost a third of our population, have pre-diabetes. This hour, where we are in the fight against this disease. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. For today, we look at the latest research on diabetes, risk factors, prevention, and the big unanswered questions that diabetes researchers are tackling. We'll also talk with an Iowan who has lived with diabetes for over 40 years. Do you have diabetes? What medical breakthroughs have made the biggest difference in your life? First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Diabetes describes a group of metabolic diseases in which a person has high blood glucose. Now, some 30 million Americans have diabetes. What's interesting here, too, is that millions of us have it but have not yet been diagnosed. Another 86 million, it's estimated, it's about a third of our population in the U.S., have what is called pre-diabetes. This hour, we look at the latest research on the different type of diabetes, risk factors, prevention, also the many unanswered questions that diabetes researchers are tackling, also right here in Iowa. But before we talk with several researchers, let's start by talking with an Iowan who has been living with diabetes for over 40 years. Julie Knight is with us. She's been living with diabetes for 43 years in our Iowa City studio. Hello, Julie.
Hi, Ben.
And we have to mention, too, we'd love to mention that you are the wife of the much talented Dan Knight, who's been heard on our airwaves many times over the years, the pianist and composer. Let's talk about your diagnosis, Julie. When were you diagnosed?
I was 10 years old when I was diagnosed with diabetes, type 1 specifically.
Type 1, and what led to the diagnosis? What symptoms were you having?
Well, my mother was a nurse, an RN. So she and I had an older brother with type 1 diabetes. So my family was informed and well aware of the symptoms: extreme thirst, extreme hunger, fatigue, even weight loss. I mean, we went through that like a drill in my family. So when I was 10, I remember we were having kind of a celebration. We were eating Reuben sandwiches, and we had milk on the table, like all families. And that day, I was extremely thirsty, and I was extremely hungry. And I figured out that I had eaten 7 halves of a Reuben sandwich, so giant piece, 7 pieces of sandwich. And then I noticed that I had gone through almost half a gallon of milk. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to sneak away from the family, and I went upstairs to our restroom where my brother had a urine test kit. It was a little vial with drops. And you put the drops of urine, the drops of water, and then you put a pill in, and it turned colors according to how much sugar was in that urine, how much glucose. And mine rapidly, for like a millisecond, was blue, which meant no sugar, and then went through all the colors until it was this like orange, muddy, rusty color, which meant that I had 4 plus urine. And I knew what that meant at 10. It meant that I had diabetes.
Mm-hmm. And what were your thoughts in that bathroom looking at that test?
Well, this is an interesting story. I don't remember. My mother and my sister remember me screaming. That's it. And then off to the hospital I went. But I don't remember what I thought except seeing that color and then the realization that I was in the hospital. Mm-hmm. That's it.
The context of this is also you have many family members who have diabetes, family members who have passed away due to diabetes.
My older brother was 35 years old. He died of kidney failure and then a massive heart attack when he was 35 at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And then I have a first cousin from my dad's identical twin who's passed away from heart failure, diabetes. And then I have 4, 5 now, other first cousins from the twins. The twins did not have diabetes, but their offspring and their grandchildren now have diabetes, type 1. So it's really prevalent in my family to a degree that's a little unusual, I believe.
You knew the consequences of this type of diagnosis more than most, certainly more than many, if not all, 10-year-olds.
I would say so, yes.
How do you deal with that type of diagnosis? How did you cope with it or come to cope with it?
Well, at 10, when they put me in the hospital, a nurse brought in a pamphlet, and I read this pamphlet about diabetes. And it said that children diagnosed with diabetes lived on average 17 to 18 years. And so my reaction, I tucked it away so my mother wouldn't see it. In my naive 10-year-old, I thought, Mom didn't know that. I didn't want to know I might die young. And then as I grew older, I was always researching, always reading to find out. And then I talked to my brother, and my brother, when he was diagnosed a few years before I was, it was only 5 to 7 years. So we've made dramatic progress in the lifespan, but it was a diagnosis that as a teenager was very difficult, being different, being unusual, understanding, oh, I probably won't live to be 30. I'll be blind. I'll lose my feet. I'll go into kidney failure. I'll die of heart failure. It was just something that kind of grew on me like moss, you know, that I carried around. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I came to school here at the University of Iowa and I met a fantastic physician. His name was Dr. Joe Brown. And his nurse, Linda Larson, and they taught me everything I needed to know and gave me what I think were like the weapons to fight this disease.
Sounds like almost a rebirth.
Yes, very much, very much. And it was when I first started checking my blood sugar. And then when I met Dan
Light.
I decided that it was worth to fight. And so here I am, 43 years later.
In those more than four decades, what do you look to as the biggest medical advances that have helped you survive and thrive as someone with diabetes?
Well, the first big change was obviously being able to check my glucose versus my urine, because checking your glucose and your urine is past history. It's what's already gone on in your body hours before. And checking my glucose, then I could know what was happening right then in the moment. And I didn't have to guess anymore. That, to me, a lot of people, peers my age at the University of Iowa as a student, were like, I'm not going to stick my finger. I'm going to do that. I'm like, what do you mean? I have to. I can't do anything without doing that. So I had an approach that I think was because there was so much diabetes in the family that I knew that you had to do these things because I saw the consequences of not doing those things. And so I think that was very important. And then the second step was when I got married, I decided to start the insulin pump. And it literally changed my life because I had freedom and flexibility to eat and to move and do the things like other people did.
And this is a portable pump?
Yeah.
You have it on you right now?
I have it on me right now.
And what is it doing right now?
It infuses on a regular basis. It's called your basal rate. And it infuses a small amount that's programmed for my individual body throughout the day that your body, your pancreas, would normally produce even when you're not eating. It just keeps you operating, keeps your glucose normal. Mm-hmm. And then when I eat, I have to count carbohydrates and count the fiber and figure out how that's going to affect my body and then dose according to that.
So it's programmed. It's not monitoring your blood.
No. But I also wear a sensor that monitors my lymph that coordinates with the pump so I can see a graph to see general changes. Doesn't mean that it's exactly right because it's a little bit of a delay, about 20 minutes delay. So, but I can see, like, if it's starting to drop, I'll go, oh, I better check because sure enough, I might be low. Mm-hmm. And it's very helpful.
So it's a combination of this technology, but also you mentioned diet you have to watch out for.
I've always watched my diet. I really do believe in you are what you eat. And the most important component when you have diabetes is counting those carbohydrates and making sure that you have enough, but not too many. It's a little dance that you play with the carbohydrates.
Julie Knight is with us. She's good enough to share her story of living with diabetes for over 43 years in this hour as we focus on diabetes. And we want to get to some of the latest research here in a moment. Julie will be with us the entire hour. And we're so grateful for her to open up about this disease so that others may have their awareness raised, perhaps, you know, get checked for diabetes if you have some of these red flag symptoms and be treated. We want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Do you have diabetes? What medical breakthroughs have made the biggest difference in your life? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, earlier this fall, the University of Iowa opened the John and Mary Papajohn Biomedical Discovery Building. It's a beautiful facility, high-tech facility dedicated in part to diabetes research, and the University of Iowa Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center which was created in 2008, has finally found its physical home there. The University of Iowa, together with the Fraternal Order of Eagles, has taken an interdisciplinary approach to tackling the disease, diabetes. Joining us also this hour, Dr. Dale Abel, director of the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center at the University of Iowa. Dr. Abel, welcome to our studio.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about the, let's start, I want to talk about the center because it's so amazing, the new facilities you have. But to jump off on what Julie was describing, her firsthand account of being diagnosed and the changes over the years, tell us, help us understand again, remind us of what's going on when we have a person who has diabetes. What's going on in the body? What's gone wrong?
So fundamentally, the body produces a hormone called insulin. And insulin plays a very important role in keeping your blood sugar levels normal. For the body to be healthy, blood sugars have to live in a very narrow range. So after you eat a meal, for example, insulin levels would rise, and that would push the glucose into your body, specifically into your muscle cells, and also tell your liver not to make glucose. What happens in diabetes, particularly what Julie had, which is called type 1 diabetes, is that you get damage to your insulin-producing cells in your pancreas. And because then you don't make insulin, then you don't have a mechanism to reduce blood sugar levels after you eat. In addition to that, your liver becomes a glucose-producing machine. And so the liver starts to overproduce glucose. And that's the other reason why blood sugar levels go very high. Mm-hmm. The last thing that insulin also does importantly is that after you eat a meal, your body has to store the calories. And one of the places that we store calories, of course, is in our fat. And insulin is very important in telling your fat cells to store calories. And when you don't have insulin, then your fat cells, in fact, release the calories as fatty acids into the blood. And these get converted by the liver into something called ketones. And that's one of the reasons, for example, in people who have no insulin with type 1 diabetes, they get these diabetic comas, because these very high levels of ketones actually will make their blood somewhat acidic. And that actually damages brain function. Mm-hmm. There's a second type of diabetes, which is called type 2 diabetes. And it turns out that type 2 diabetes is actually significantly more common than type 1 diabetes.
By a large factor, what, 90-some
percent? Yeah, about 95% of all diabetes is type 2 diabetes. And what's different between type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes is that whereas in type 1 diabetes there's sort of complete loss and destruction of the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas, in type 2 diabetes, what actually happens is that the body, for various reasons, actually gets resistant to insulin. So it's not that you don't have any insulin, it's just that your cells don't respond to insulin very well. And eventually what happens then is that the pancreas cells try to secrete more and more insulin to try to overcome the block. And eventually at some point it kind of wears out, and then you get this mismatch. And then again, you have some of the same issues happening with the blood sugar levels rising.
One other type of diabetes associated with pregnancy.
Correct.
As well.
So there's another kind of diabetes called gestational diabetes. And so gestational diabetes occurs in certain women, usually in the middle of their pregnancy. And women who get gestational diabetes sometimes are at higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes later on in life. And this is important because if you're diabetic at the time of that you're pregnant, then the high blood sugars can also have effects on the developing fetus.
Mm-hmm. So with the high blood sugars in the bloodstream left untreated, we have heard, Julie, and commonly known the symptoms of thirst and hunger here. First of all, trace that back. What is the body trying to tell us? What is it trying to do when we're very thirsty or very hungry in this situation?
Yeah, so what happens when you have uncontrolled diabetes is that the kidney, which is the organ that makes urine, it filters this glucose and actually drives a lot of water into your bladder. And so you actually do get dehydrated when you have uncontrolled diabetes. And so one of the reasons why Julie was very thirsty is because her kidney was actually trying to filter all this glucose and pulling fluid from her circulation. And so her brain sensed that as thirst, and therefore she tried to drink as much fluid as possible to restore the fluid that was being lost by her kidney.
Mm-hmm. Left untreated, what is the damage that incurs in the body?
Right. So diabetes actually causes a significant number of complications. They largely affect the following parts of the body. They can affect the eyes. We call that diabetic retinopathy. They can affect the kidneys. And in fact, diabetes is the leading cause of kidney failure. It can also affect the nerves. We call that diabetic neuropathy. And people will have pain. They'll have loss of sensation. And this is one of the reasons, for example, why people with diabetes are at higher risk of having foot infections, having amputations and the like. The biggest cause of disability in individuals with diabetes is heart attacks and strokes. We call that microvascular disease. So people with diabetes are probably 10 to 20 times more likely to have a stroke or a heart attack, and certainly have a much higher risk of developing heart failure.
Complications. Julie Knight, what have you experienced in terms of complications?
Well, actually, a little bit of all of that after 43 years. The major complication that I had was before I started on the insulin pump. And after Dan and I were married, I got pregnant. And the first complication that showed up for me was in my eyes because of that pregnancy. Now, I miscarried, but as a result, I ended up with having to have a lot of laser treatment and a vitrectomy, and I did get my vision restored. But I was nearly blind for a year. And part of the reason was because of other health reasons, I couldn't go under surgery. And so when I did have surgery, I had a vitrectomy, and the people here at the University of Iowa in the ophthalmology department saved my sight. And I was one of the first people to actually go through that. I ran into the physician that did the surgery, Dr. Folk at the University of Iowa, and he said that he put so much laser in my eye, and it was one of the first, that he really thought steam was going to blow out of my ears. And I had no idea I was going through that, but it didn't matter. I was willing to try whatever it took to get my vision back. And, you know, when my niece, my brother's daughter, she was 11 when she was diagnosed with diabetes. And she, so she came to my house and she saw me checking my glucose. And she's like, you know, I really want to try that. I really want to try that. And so I said, okay, you know, we'll get a new fresh, you know, stick. And I checked her glucose and it was 374.
And what does that mean?
That's
very, very high. So it was during the Super Bowl. So we waited till after the Super Bowl was over because my brother refused to leave the game. And we went to the hospital. But the reason I bring her up is because she was diagnosed later. She was using, you know, a glucose monitor and following her diet fairly well. And she was able to get pregnant and have a child. And she did have a little trouble with her eyes, but they prevented any problems. So that's the big difference between when I was a young woman and then now my niece. You know, she's 30-something now. I hate to admit that. But she's done quite well because of the good control and the better control and the things that we're able to do for her. And the early diagnosis, you know, she hadn't even gone into ketoacidosis, which a lot of children do end up going into ketoacidosis when they're first diagnosed. So she was... Things have improved quite a bit. So I don't want it to sound all doom and gloom.
If you've just joined us, we're talking about diabetes this hour. A firsthand account from Julie Knight. Also, we're talking about the latest research with Dr. Dale Abel. If you'd like to join us, if you have a question about diabetes, or perhaps you have diabetes and want to share an experience or an advance that has made a big difference in your life, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You could tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Let's talk about this, which is an enormous number, Dr. Abel, of undiagnosed people with diabetes in this country. Did I correctly see about 8 million is an estimate?
I'm 18.
18.
80.
80, okay, 80 who have it.
Who have pre-diabetes,
Pre-diabetes. Right. So tell us about these groups, the undiagnosed mm-hmm. and the pre-diabetes groups.
Sure. So as I'd mentioned earlier, that type 2 diabetes is the most prevalent cause of diabetes in the world. And an important risk factor for type 2 diabetes is obesity. And if one looks at trends in obesity and overweight in the United States, and of course globally, that has increased quite dramatically over the last 20 years or so, to the extent to which over a third to 40% of the U.S. population is obese. It turns out that as you become overweight and obese, that the body becomes more resistant to insulin, and it causes the pancreas to start working harder. And in contrast to Julie, where with type 1 diabetes, she lost her pancreas cells and she had this dramatic initial presentation. For many people with type 2 diabetes, it's much more subtle in terms of the onset. And therefore, people may actually feel perfectly fine for many years and not be aware that their blood sugars are rising slowly and not be aware that their pancreas might be gradually failing, which is one of the reasons why it becomes very important for people to be screened, especially if they are at high risk, if they're overweight or if they have a strong family history, because that sometimes might be the only way that we can make the diagnosis.
And the screening would happen in an annual physical?
That's right. The screening is very simple. It's just a blood test. There are two tests that we do. We can ask someone to come in and measure their glucose level after an overnight fast before breakfast, or they can measure another thing in the blood called the hemoglobin A1C, which they can do without fasting. And both of those can be used to make the diagnosis of diabetes or the diagnosis of prediabetes.
If someone listening to this program, or they themselves or a family member has some of the symptoms that we've been talking about here, I suppose the advice, as always, go to your primary care provider?
Sure. And it doesn't have to be a physician. They could go and see a nurse or a nurse practitioner who can easily take the blood sample and do the screening test.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about the history of this before we go to a break. How long has diabetes been around? What do we know about that, Dr. Abel?
So that's a good, very good question. So way back in the time of, Aristotle, back in the Greek era, there were patients who had diabetes and they were thirsty and they peed a lot. And it turns out that when they peed on the ground, honeybees would come and actually sit in the pee. And so they call it diabetes because the root of diabetes is actually too much urine. That's the original root for that. And they call it diabetes mellitus because that was the word for honey, which meant sweet urine. So this was actually known a couple thousand years ago as a real disease. Of course, back then, before insulin was discovered over 100 years ago, people who had type 1 diabetes pretty much would die within a year or two. I suspect there were people with type 2 diabetes who maybe lived a little bit longer, but ultimately, I'm sure, still suffered many complications as well.
Mm-hmm. So type 1 diabetes, that's pretty much, we think, stayed constant throughout human history, and type 2 has increased because of our diet, or?
So it's a tricky question in the sense that, obviously, because of the discovery of insulin, we could actually treat type 1 diabetes better. So it therefore meant that people with type 1 diabetes were living longer. People at risk for type 1 diabetes were having families. And so, in fact, type 1 diabetes has actually gradually increased as we have actually gotten better at treating it. Type 2 diabetes has also increased because I think as we have become wealthier and have more food, et cetera, we've also become more obese.
Okay, fascinating area of research and discussion. We're understanding diabetes affects some 80 million Americans, almost a third of our population. Also, pre-diabetes being described here by Dr. Dale Abel, director of the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center at the University of Iowa. We do want to talk about that new home for the research center when we come back. Julie Knight is also with us. She's been living with diabetes for over 43 years. Your questions about diabetes this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Also, when we come back, James Ankrum will join us. He's a biomedical engineer, and he'll tell us about new advances in treating symptoms, research working on there, and also prevention. Charles Brenner will be with us as well, and we'd love to have you with us over the second half hour. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about diabetes this hour. Diabetes research as well. Julie Knight is with us. She's been living with diabetes for over 40 years, telling us about her experiences. Dr. Dale Abel is with us as well, director of the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center, which has found a new home at the University of Iowa. We invite you to join us with your questions about diabetes and experiences. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, or email, tweet us at IPRTalk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave your question or your comment. Turns out diabetes, very expensive disease to treat, costing the United States an estimated $244 billion back in 2012. The loss of productivity, is figured in due to illness, disability. The bill comes to $322 billion. That's $1,000 a year for each American, including those without diabetes. And for a person diagnosed with diabetes, the average economic burden is over $10,000. And Julie, does that fit in with your experience?
Well, I actually spend more than that. Because I wear an insulin pump and the supplies, and it varies depending on which insurance policy you have. But just my pump, insulin pump supplies every month are over $1,000.
We want to get to callers 1-866-780-9100, also emails. First of all, I would like to have Dr. Abel tell us about the new center, the physical new home at the John and Mary Papa John Biomedical Discovery Building. They do a lot of things in this spanking new building, but diabetes research is a big part of it. It's an interdisciplinary approach. Tell us about what's going on there.
Sure. So it was really a wonderful opportunity to come into this role, to lead the Diabetes Research Center, which was endowed by a significant gift from the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes, from the Fraternal Order of Eagles. The center is home to a large number of scientists. There are actually 100 scientists in the center who are faculty members at the University of Iowa, and about a dozen who live physically in the new facility. They span multiple disciplines. You'll be hearing from a couple members soon in this program, but we are studying how to prevent certain complications of diabetes, such as heart failure in my lab, to ways to prevent the liver from making too much glucose, for example, in another lab, to ways to make beta cells more resistant to being rejected when they are transplanted. One of the very nice things about the Diabetes Research Center is that it's if you walk through the facility, it's a big open space. So we have very few walls. And the idea behind that is that we have all of our researchers in the same space doing their research, literally bouncing into each other multiple times throughout the course of the day. Because one of the things that really makes research go faster is to have very smart people talking with each other and interacting with each other literally on in real time, because that's then the way that ideas get multiplied and solutions will in fact come around much more quickly.
Is this this open architecture a reflection of perhaps the idea that perhaps looking back over research in past years that people have been too pigeonholed in certain areas, and that this as you say, talking with one another results in faster, better research?
Well, I think that one of the things that we are realizing more as knowledge has improved and as science has gotten more complex, that no one person will ever figure this thing out completely. And whereas there have been tremendous advances over the years, and I don't want to minimize that at all, that we still have this urgency to accelerate the pace at which we make new discoveries because of people like Julie who are waiting for us to do that, as well as the fact that diabetes is continuing to grow in our community. So by changing the model in a way to maximize collaboration and to maximize team efforts towards working towards the research goal, I think will bring about the solutions much more rapidly.
I want to talk to a couple of other people involved in some 100 faculty involved in this new center for diabetes research. But tell us briefly about your lab. You are concentrating on, you mentioned it, the risk of diabetes to the heart, to the coronary system.
So, you know, one of the major causes of death and disability in people with diabetes is heart disease. And it turns out that diabetes will increase your risk of developing heart failure. And if you develop heart failure and you're diabetic, the likelihood that you may succumb from that is actually somewhat higher than if you are not diabetic. Our lab, therefore, has focused on trying to understand what is it about the diabetic environment that affects heart muscle function. And to sort of summarize it very quickly, what we have shown is that when you're sort of flooded with too much glucose and also too much fatty acids, because as I mentioned earlier, the fat cells release all these fatty acids into the circulation, it actually presents the heart with too much food in a way, because the heart has to convert this energy to keep pumping. And the increased supply of fatty acids and glucose to the heart actually leads to damage of heart muscle cells and damage to the ability of the heart to make energy and to pump adequately.
Join our conversation. What questions do you have about diabetes? Perhaps you have diabetes and would like to share an experience. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Scott. Scott is in Iowa City. Hello, Scott.
Hello there. How are you doing, Ben?
We're doing fine, Scott. What's your question?
Well, my question to the doctor has to do with exercise and diabetes, because it seems to be the major solution from a lot of people. I'm one of those creepers. My numbers in the morning are 110. Now they're up to 120, occasionally 130. So first of all, I'm curious what's happening in my body. I'm on metformin, so I'm trying to take care of it. But is exercise? I want to know what happens physiologically. Why is exercise such an important part of my regimen?
Okay, Scott, great question from Iowa City. Thank you.
Scott, that's a great question. So it turns out that when you exercise and your muscle contracts, it actually increases the capacity of the muscle to take up glucose. So one of the reasons why exercise becomes a really important aspect of managing your diabetes is that your muscle actually becomes like a sponge to actually take glucose out of your circulation. And the other thing that exercise also does is that it actually makes your muscle a much more efficient fat burner. And therefore, that can also have a big impact on controlling body weight, for example.
Dr. Dale Abel is with us, director of the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center at the University of Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. James Ankrum joins us now, a biomedical engineer at the University of Iowa at the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center, also assistant professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Iowa. James, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Thanks for being on the program. Tell us, you're involved with this program. Tell us about the focus of your research.
Yeah, one of the new recruits to the center, so I just started my lab here in August, and I work in a field called regenerative medicine, which actually has a lot of applications for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Type 1 for actually trying to replace the insulin-producing cells in these patients so they don't need a pump anymore, and type 2 diabetics to be able to try to have better treatments for many of the complications, such as diabetic wounds, heart attacks that patients suffer. So within that, I work in a subfield called cell-based therapies, where we actually try to take healthy cells from donors that have the potential to promote healing and restore function in diabetic patients. And so we try to figure out ways that we can actually take these cells and help them make the transition from a dish in our lab into a pathological environment where they can then promote healing and restore function to these tissues that have really been ravaged by these the effects of diabetes.
James, what are the challenges you're finding in these cell-based therapies, introducing new cells into a body to help the healing?
So it's actually quite a shock. So I like to use the analogy of kind of climbing a mountain to explain the transition that cells go through. So there's many people right now sitting at home or in their office. They probably have potential to climb a mountain, but the key word there is potential. If you pluck them out of their warm home and their stocked fridge and place them on top of a mountain in Colorado, they're likely not to do so well without, you know, they're just simply not prepared. They don't have the right gear. They're going to freeze to death, starve to death, et cetera. And so that's not the way we climb mountains, though. Instead, we train for the hike. We gather gear like jackets, GPS devices. We take all our food and bug spray with us. And so with all these assistive devices, the hike is successful. And so cells have quite a similar challenge. They're going from an incubator in my lab where they get all the nutrients they want. There's no stresses. There's no insults to them. And then we pluck them up out of that dish and we inject them into an inflamed tissue where there's very low nutrients. There's a lot of inflammatory cells around. And in that shock, the cells often die, or if they don't die, they often lose their function. And so even though they have potential to promote healing and to restore function to that tissue, they often fail to live up to that potential. So in my lab, we look at how can we develop technologies for the cell itself to support it along that journey, going from the dish in a lab to actually being a functional therapy in the patient.
Mm-hmm. So help us understand, in the future, you're working towards what goal, what application?
So we are currently working on a project focused on diabetic wounds. So I work with a cell type called mesenchymal stem cell. Harvested from bone marrow, and it's capable of promoting growth of new blood vessels as well as decreasing inflammation. And these are two important things for diabetic wounds. Many diabetics, you know, Julie mentioned earlier being that fear of having a leg amputated. That's often because there's wounds will arise on the lower limbs of diabetic patients, and they can persist for years without healing. So there's a fundamental breakdown in that normal healing process. Well, the cells that we work with are capable of actually orchestrating and remodeling that wound environment so that normal native healing can resume. So we're looking at ways that we can actually help transplant these cells in such a way that we can really maximize their ability to promote that wound healing response.
I think Dr. Abel wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, I just want to make one other comment because there's much time to talk about this. But I think that in addition to what James described for wounds, that some of his work in terms of engineering cells may ultimately also have an effect on making cells that we can actually use to replace the beta cells, which are the cells that produce insulin. And certainly in terms of something that ultimately could be viewed as a cure for diabetes, it's going to be being able to put beta cells back into individuals that can actually make insulin like the ones that they lost.
That's absolutely. So we really try to build these technologies as platforms that can be used with different types of cells. So I'm beginning some collaborations with some folks to do just what Dr. Abel mentioned. And, the hope there is that beta cell therapy right now is still in experimental stages. Oftentimes after a couple of years after the transplant, many of the cells will die. So that's something that we don't want to happen and really can't happen at the scale that of a patient we want to treat. So the hope is by using some of these technologies and developing them, we can enhance the efficiency of this process so that we can actually make beta cell replacement a reality for type 1 diabetics, as well as give real restorative treatments to type 2 diabetics.
James Ankrum, thank you very much. Biomedical engineer at the University of Iowa Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center. Thanks, James.
All right, thank you.
Let's turn to another colleague of these gentlemen involved in this new program. Charles Brenner is with us, the Roy J. Carver Chair and Professor of Biochemistry, Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa, also co-director of the University of Iowa Obesity Research and Education Initiative. Charles, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you for being with us. Now, tell us about the focus of your work on sort of the front end, the prevention here, aren't you?
Yes, I'm a basic scientist. I'm interested in basic mechanisms of fuel utilization and fat storage. So animals are kind of programmed to store excess macronutrients. We eat everything that has calories is called a macronutrient, carbohydrates, protein, fat. All of those are fuels for our body, but our bodies are sort of programmed and evolved in order to store excess energy as fat. And so my laboratory is interested in understanding the intrinsic switches that occur inside of cells that allow a cell to figure out how much energy it has, how much energy it needs, and how a cell makes a switch between fuel utilization, burning fuel, and then storing the fat. And we think that we may be able to modulate some of these pathways in order to promote weight loss.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that if you take your high school or your basic college biology, we think we understand cells. But listening to you, it sounds like there is a lot we do not know.
There's a lot of mysteries in cells. There's a lot of mysteries in the mitochondrial compartment, which is part of every cell, the part in which most of the ATP is generated. And turns out the proteins change over time. The proteins are modified by metabolites that are related to the utilization of energy. And the modification of these proteins affects their function.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that there are some relationships between macronutrients, those carbs, proteins, and fats, and the micronutrients in our diet. And everything about our diet and lifestyle has been changed in the latter half of the 20th century.
Yes, let's talk about that. It's not for the better, I think, with diabetes in mind. What do our modern diets include that we know there's no question about it? It's just prompting type 2 diabetes.
Well, junk food, Ben. our diet is really rich in concentrated macronutrients. So it's very easy. It's very relatively inexpensive for us to go into a fast food restaurant with just a few dollars or a credit card and obtain thousands of calories that many of those calories in, the burger, the fries, and the soft drink are concentrated macronutrients. So lots of fat in the fries, lots of protein in the burger, lots of refined sugar in the soft drink. And you put those three categories of processed macronutrient together without all of the other cellular stuff that it came from, and you could actually have a nutritional problem. You combine that with our physical inactivity, the fact that most of us didn't actually have to grow that food or hunt for that food or expend a whole lot of energy in acquiring those energy inputs, and we really do have a metabolic equation that is difficult to solve without reducing our energy inputs or increasing our energy expenditure, we tend to have a metabolic problem.
Mm-hmm. So the answer is, and I can probably ask you, what do you look out for when you sit down for dinner or lunch or breakfast to make sure you get this more complex nutrition than what might have the case with junk food?
You tend to do better with food that is less processed. And so, you know, you don't have to give up meat, although meat certainly has a very high density of macronutrients, but smaller portions of meat, larger portions of vegetables, more complex carbohydrates, less refined sugar, less refined high glycemic index carbohydrate would tend to be a healthier diet than a highly refined junk food diet.
Okay. Do you have a breakthrough in mind in your area that you're looking on the horizon to conquer?
Well, I hope we can. We're active in a couple of different areas. One is really early on. As Dr. Abel said, there's 80 million Americans with pre-diabetes, a third obese, another third are overweight. And so we think that there may be some micronutritional approaches to weight management, and we're investigating those in our laboratory. And then towards the end of the diabetic disease spectrum, as he and Julie Knight described, is this diabetic peripheral neuropathy. And again, we think that there may be a micronutritional or a vitamin approach to prevent or reverse diabetic peripheral neuropathy. We're working on those things in the laboratory.
Okay. Very quick, we have just a few minutes left. I wanted to get in this email from a listener. Are the guests aware of the research linking dairy consumption to increased risk? The emailer writes, I'm pretty sure I have type 2. I get the majority of my calories from cow's milk. Dr. Abel, perhaps you can tackle that?
Right. So there's some controversy about the link between dairy and diabetes. There is some evidence, largely from Scandinavia, that increased use of dairy may be tied in with an increased risk of type 1 diabetes in children. Again, I say that it is controversial. That being said, there's also some recent work that suggested that individuals who drink a lot of whole milk are getting not just the protein and the calcium, but also getting the fat in the milk. And so that, again, can contribute to the obesity, et cetera, that can then be a risk of developing type 2.
Dr. Abel, I'm sorry to say we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you very quickly about research and research dollars. Mm-hmm. Here, too. We've done past shows about the research dollars falling off. Are you having the same challenge?
Yes. So most research in the United States in health comes from the National Institutes of Health, and those dollars have been flat and, in fact, shrinking for the last 5 to 6 years, that the success rate of getting your research funded is now dropping to less than 1 to 10. And therefore, it means that the pace at which we can make these important advances are at risk unless we are able to identify additional resources either from the NIH or from donors such as the Eagles, who have allowed us to do research that otherwise would not have been funded.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Charles Brenner, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And before we leave, perhaps it's best to give that advice again, Dr. Abel, of what if people want to get checked out here? They've had some antenna have gone up, perhaps some and the symptoms, what should a person do?
Absolutely. So if you have any risk factor for diabetes, such as being obese or overweight, or you have a strong family history, or you have any symptoms, such as increased thirst, increased urination, certain infections on the skin that don't heal very well, then it's very easy to go into your neighborhood clinic and have a blood sugar or a hemoglobin A1C checked. It takes a few seconds.
Okay, Dr. Dale Abel, Director of the Fraternal Order of Eagles Diabetes Research Center at the University of Iowa. Thank you, Dr. Abel, for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Julie Knight, for kicking off our show and giving us a nice personal story so we can understand what it's like to be living with diabetes, living with diabetes for over 40 years. Many, many years to come, we hope, Julie Knight. It's been a pleasure having you in the studio.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure.
Charles Brenner, thank you. I think we said goodbye to him, but thank you again. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, it's a News Buzz edition of our program. We'll hope you'll join us then. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for being with us.